mega accident story is a staple in the news. Rescues on the water, off cliffs, and on the highway seem to happen almost weekly in the Columbia Pacific region. Today's guests are the guys who are waiting at the end of the accident chain. They're trauma surgeons. Dr. Robert Wayne practices in Astoria. Dr. Bill Long is chief of trauma surgery at Legacy Emanuel Hospital in Portland. He's also an occasional presence at Columbia Memorial Hospital. We'll start our conversation about trauma surgery in our region with Dr. Wayne. Welcome to After Deadline, Bob.
Good morning.
Astoria, our Astoria Hospital, Columbia Memorial, is known as a Level 3 trauma center. What does that mean?
Well, the state has developed rules for the different levels of trauma center. And just so you get the picture, the Level 1s are all in Portland. There are virtually no Level 2s because they're so close to 1s that they elected to make the nearer hospital 3s as a rule. A Level 3 is required – different requirements. The Level 1s, of course, have in-house brain surgeon, anesthesia, and even a surgeon. That's the requirement of those to meet that stipulation. Level 3s have to have the surgeon and the anesthesia available within about 30 minutes of the time the trauma is initiated. That means from the time that either an EMT in the field or a doctor in the emergency room says, let's get the team. And that's the main difference is that we have a don't have in-house people. There are other resources that are very different between a Level 1 and a Level 2. For instance, the cardiac bypass machine is available at a Level 1, wouldn't be here. But the biggest issue is the team is in-house in a Level 1 and is assembled in a Level 3. And remember that the purpose of the assembly is to get together before the patient shows up or as early as close to the time when the patient shows up. And we've had some cases recently where the whole crew was here before the patient arrived.
Wow.
This is the premise.
What is your – to use the parlance of the workplace, what's your shift at the hospital?
Shift? You mean how long do I work
for
a day?
Yeah.
Well, I get – it's a shift, so 24 hours for each of the surgeons here. We have 4.5 surgeons. The half is a visitor from Portland periodically. But it's usually a 24-hour shift, and sometimes we'll do a few in a row. There isn't a lot of call for trauma in that time. It may be just one or two, but that's the shift at 24
hours. But you are the surgeon on call at that point.
Oh, yeah.
If that's the word, yeah.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing this here?
32 years.
Here in Astoria?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Came on staff around 78 or 79.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose that none of your days could be called typical, but describe a day for us.
Oh, today would have been a more typical day. Typical day is to do surgery in the morning, usually before noon, try to get some lunch in. Doesn't always happen, especially if I'm on call. And usually have an office hour from, say, 1:30 till about 4 or 5. And then hopefully that's the end of my day, but it's highly variable. My day starts usually at 4 o'clock. I wake up and go right to the computer, and then I try to make rounds by about before 6 in the morning, and then that's how I go.
So that a trauma case comes randomly, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there is no plan for that. And how long has it been this week since you've seen a trauma case that you had to
I've been on call several days, and I've had no trauma cases. There was a serious one yesterday, but I wasn't on call.
Yeah, yeah. Why did you want to be a surgeon?
Boy, you're really making me go back to my roots. I found it challenging. I like mechanical things. I think orthopedics wouldn't have been outside of the question too, because you use your hands to do a lot of things. And I guess the biggest thing is it encompasses a very wide breadth of activity. When I moved here, over 30 years ago, I could do a hysterectomy and put in a pacemaker. And if nobody was looking, maybe I'd even nail a hip. I mean, those are things I would never do today. We were trained as general surgeons, very broad-based. Today, I really stick to just gallbladders and hernias and a lot of endoscopy.
Is there special training for being a trauma surgeon?
Oh, yeah. There are trauma fellowships. Bill has several. Dr. Long will be speaking. He has several in his program. And these fellows spend, I think, 2 years, I'm going to guess, in the program going beyond just residency and all the usual training to be a surgeon to get this additional trauma training. I got a lot of my trauma training along the way because trauma really grew up around me as a, more of a practice than when I started. When I started, there was no such thing as trauma surgeons. You know, Oregon in 1978 had regular physicians that covered the emergency room and saw trauma, but they weren't trauma physicians, so to speak. I think Bill only developed trauma programs in about 82 or 83, I'm going to say, and then they spread around the country so that there are a lot more of them now.
Tell us about your most challenging or exciting trauma case.
It's 1978. I'm 6 months in Seaside Hospital, I think, as a solo surgeon. I've got about four or five colleagues in private practice, but I'm the only surgeon, really. John O'Donovan was still working down there those days, but he wasn't doing much surgery. And we got a 21-year-old patient bit by a shark. It was a big white, and we knew a lot about him because the patient was bit with the board on the board, so the teeth were left in the bottom of the board, and his back was raked off. But we knew a lot about this shark because of his teeth and the bite. As I received him, I was actually in the operating room doing a double hernia with Dr. Wally Schaefer, a long-term physician in Seaside. And this is at Seaside Hospital. And the call came in that we were getting a shark bite. And it was 10 in the morning or something. We were in the middle of hernia surgery. And I turned to Wally and I said, well, I guess you'll be doing the rest of the surgery, you know. And within minutes, the shark bite came in. Wally finished the surgeries, accidentally. And I went to take care of this young man. He was alert. He was talking, confused, of course, in very deep shock, very hypothermic, core temperature of 88. I mean, just really bad. And, of course, very little blood pressure. And was laying on a gurney as they brought him in. And very seriously injured, but talking, like I say, and quite cold. So we immediately started some lines to give him lots of fluid because we knew he'd lost a lot from his injuries. And then I rolled him up on his right shoulder so I could see where the injury was on his left back and flank. And the shark had basically laid him open from his scapula, that's the shoulder blade, clear down to below, almost to his tailbone. In a zigzag fashion, you'd almost think someone took a scalpel and did it because there was clean, big zigzag cuts all the ways down. And, of course, the lung fell out the back of the hole, I mean, you know, because he'd lost several ribs.
His lung fell out the back of the...
Well, it came right out where there was no ribs in there.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much to do but just... pack it. I put a bunch of towels and things in there. I did get a tube into his lung, which I think couldn't do much, but we tried to re-expand it, whatever we could, and laid him on all that. That's what I just laid him back on it. We were pushing. In those days, we used a thing called mass trousers. They blew up on your legs and we thought they raised the blood pressure in the body and helped us because you were low of fluids in your body, basically. And so I used the mass trousers on him and got the lines in him and basically took off in the ambulance. That was after we thought we had some degree of stabilization. We took blood with us and several units, and then we drove up towards Providence. We were heading towards what's the hospital across town where
Emmanuel?
No, it's the other. It's a 7-day Adventist. Mm. I knew a trauma surgeon, Dwayne Beats, in those days. That was the only one. I had only been here 6 months. And we got him on the line, and we were heading for that hospital across town, not the closest hospital, not a trauma center because there weren't any. And about halfway up, I get choked up when I talk about it because it was very unusual. Kenny was talking to me. He was still
– Kenny is the patient.
Kenny – I don't think he'd mind. He wrote a book about this, so we're not saying anything bad about him. Kenny has since passed away from natural causes. But the kid who was bit by the shark. And Kenny was talking to me somewhat. As we hit the tunnel, I'd gotten several units of blood into him and fluid. He suddenly started to really crash. His blood pressure went away again. And I knew there was blood leaking out a lot of places, and I knew he was going to die. So I blew up the mask trousers again because they had deflated. And we put the abdominal compartment on him. Son of a bee, his blood pressure came right back. Made me a believer immediately. They've taken them off the mark. I don't think you can get mask trousers anymore. Yeah. But Kenny woke up again, you know. Well, now I knew I was in deep whatever. Yeah. And we were at the tunnel on Highway 26. So I made a change in plan. I decided to go to St. V's. I didn't know many people at St. Vincent's, but it was a hell of a lot closer than going across town, and I think they needed the nearest hospital. So that was our plan. We pulled into St. V's. He was there, I think, several – I don't know, several weeks. He got 600 stitches, and they fixed him back up. He went back to surfing and raising his two boys over time. But that was the most exciting case that I can remember way back.
Wow. This is After Deadline. We're speaking with Dr. Bob Wayne of Astoria. And our topic today is trauma surgery. When we come back from our break, we'll talk with Dr. Bill Long. Resume our After Deadline show with Dr. Bill Long of Portland. Welcome to After Deadline, Dr. Long.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Surgeons and trauma surgeons are a special breed. Where do they fit in the spectrum of medicine?
There are surgeons who have completed general surgery as part of the training. That's usually a 5-year residency program. And then they have a defined fellowship of trauma surgery in general, which they learn the techniques of trauma surgery and critical care that goes with it. And that's 1 to 2 years, mostly 2 years now.
And from what Bob Wayne was saying earlier, and I did not realize this, it's a relatively recent specialty.
Well, it's,
or at least in Oregon it is.
Yeah, in the sense that when wartime, all general surgeons become trauma surgeons because there's no other opportunity. I mean there's no other source to go toward. But in civilian trauma, it was the surgeons coming back from the Vietnamese War who felt that we needed to have equal facilities of what they had available for the soldiers. And so there was a surgeon in Denver who basically got this started by having a hospital built by a helicopter to bring patients off the highways in there. The guy's name was Hank Cleveland. And from that became the first Air Force, so to speak, related to emergency medical service to bring patients off highways and bypassing traffic jams to bring patients in and get them on the operating room table. There were other programs such as Dr. Trunke's program, Bill Blaisdell's program in San Francisco General. That was one of the first West Coast programs. And there's one at Harborview in Seattle, extension of the University of Washington. They had a training program, and it got to be quite large. And I was a medical student when all this was going down in Baltimore. And Dr. R. Adams Callie was a cardiothoracic surgeon who got very interested in trauma because some of the problems related to shock and trauma are very similar to that in heart surgery. And he built a trauma center there with both federal and state money and bought 5 helicopters and covered the whole state. So he had the imagination to provide the delivery system to bring patients, severely injured patients from all over the whole state into Baltimore. And then had a critical care unit and got all this the other specialists that you need in trauma, neurosurgeons, maxillofacial surgeons and plastic surgeons, chest surgeons, abdominal surgeon or general surgeons, orthopedic surgeons, vascular surgeon, urologists, and had them all committed to come running as soon as he blew the whistle.
So here in Astoria, we're I won't say it's a common occurrence, but we sort of know when the Life Flight helicopter comes in and leaves because it's not a Coast Guard chopper, and it's not a television news chopper, and so it leaves CMH, let's say, and heads to your place. What happens at the other end when they come off the helicopter?
Well, it depends upon what kind of shape they're in.
Know they're coming, obviously.
Yes. Yeah, so we get a phone call, and it says we're sending this patient, and they tell us what the mechanism of injury, they tell us what they've done and the diagnostic tests that they've done and what kind of shape they are, and then we get an update by the helicopter crew on the way. And then we make the appropriate preparations for that patient's arrival. If they're stable, meaning that they have a normal blood pressure, heart rate, and things like that, we see them in the emergency department, and we may do more x-rays and tests and then decide what surgeries we're going to do right away and what surgeries we're going to do in a few days' time. On the other hand, if they're unstable, then we go directly to the operating room because that means we have to give them a lot of blood. We have to have like a pit crew at the Indianapolis 500. We have to have a lot of people working simultaneously to keep them alive, and we provide that level of care with that kind of patient that's deteriorating as they arrive.
You've described the kind of preparation or schooling that you go through to become a trauma surgeon, but a lot of it, I suspect, is aptitude or personality, too. I'm aware of this in just our workplace here, but some people want to have their lives scheduled and other people are ready to take whatever comes through the door. Someone who's handling a company's online services, for instance, has to be ready to take whatever comes through the door. And being a trauma surgeon, it certainly sounds as though you're not like the physician who has his day mapped out by appointments of people coming in to see him in the office, shall we say. How does that get selected out? Is it a self-selection process, or does someone consciously ask the question of the candidate to become a trauma surgeon? Now, are you comfortable with the idea that you get up in the morning, you don't know what's going to be coming your way?
Well, most of it is self-selected. As they finish up their general surgical residency, those individuals who like trauma, they like the Sturm und Drang, the excitement, the challenges of it, basically asked to for training programs or fellowship programs if they can be trained. And so they go through a selection process, and you try to find someone who has some team leading capabilities, who knows how to get along with the different surgical personalities of the various specialties, and they do have markedly different personalities. And they have to be able to work well with nurses, respiratory therapists, pre-hospital care personnel, and in addition, knowing how to cut and sew and being part of putting organs back together and tissues back together. So they sort of select themselves out, but we also sometimes, unfortunately, have to drop people from the program because they're not team leaders. They have to be a team leader.
Well, this gets to something you said to the Oregonian recently. It ran the Sunday prior to when we're recording this. You said doctors are trained to be individuals. It takes 5 years to figure out if they'll play on a team.
That's correct.
Which describes, I guess, the basic challenge of taking a physician, a standard issue physician, if there is such a thing, and say, okay, now you're part of a team, because they didn't cover that in med school.
Right. Most surgeons basically, you know, as Bob points out, he likes to do gallbladders and colon surgery and other things and endoscopy. And so he does that by himself, pretty much with a nurse or some people to help him. Neurosurgeons basically operate by themselves. Now, all of a sudden, you have somebody with major trauma and they have head, face, chest, abdomen, pelvis, and extremities all broken up. Now you have five surgeons operating simultaneously. Somebody has to be the quarterback. They have to know enough about each other's specialty. They have to have the confidence of the other specialists with the big egos to sit there and listen to them and be able to direct and orchestrate how this is going to take place. Otherwise, it would be chaos with everybody doing their own thing simultaneously.
Okay. Describe your relationship or your arrangement with Columbia Memorial Hospital.
Goes back to 1983 when I first came to Oregon. I was basically getting started at Emanuel, and one of the first surgeons I met from the rural community was Bob Wayne. And we struck up a friendship. We exchanged some experiences, and he invited me down to Columbia Memorial Hospital. And Astoria is very much like a town that I grew up in Maryland called Crisfield. It was the crab capital of the world, they called themselves. And it was at the end of a train line, and they shipped all these mollusks and crabs, you know, in New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. That was their industry. Mm. And they had a little hospital there, 35 beds, and I did some part-time work there. So Bob got me involved to cover him because he was basically one of the only surgeons in the community at that time when he went out of town and took vacation. So he was kind enough to lend me his car and his house, and I would stay there and drive in to take call at Columbia Memorial Hospital. And because I was used to growing up in that kind of community, it was kind of fun, and that's how we arranged it for many years.
So did you do some trauma cases while you were here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Describe one of them, if you can remember that far back.
Well, probably a ruptured spleen, we would take that out. There could be a stab wound or something like that. We'd deal with that. I don't remember anything extraordinary where I was basically called to do open-heart surgery or something like that, but you know, during the times when you weren't operating, you'd hang around the hospital, you'd teach a little bit in the emergency department nurses, you'd talk to the OR nurses and things like that.
I'd like to ask you the same question I asked Bob, which is tell us your most challenging or exciting case that you've worked on in trauma surgery.
In Oregon or here or anywhere?
Well, anywhere.
Okay.
But I've heard you speak about one particular one in Oregon, but go ahead.
Well, though, I guess one of the most challenges not too long ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, she was a student for University of Portland and went on an expedition to climb Mount Adams. And they had summited, were coming back down, and were about 8,000 feet when a 400-pound boulder, for whatever reason, came tumbling down and hit her flat on the back and knocked her about 200 feet down the mountainside. Almost killed her. It wasn't for the snow or whatever. But to do a mountain rescue at that altitude is extraordinary. So there's a series of circumstances that only God could have arranged. It was amazing. They had a military helicopter crew over in Yakima. They had never done a high mountain rescue. They were from Wisconsin. They had to call back to Washington, D.C. to get permission to do the rescue. Then they had to figure out how to do the rescue at 8,000 feet, get this girl in there. And then as they took off to head for Portland, a manual for reasons, they ran out of gas. The yellow light went on, and so that meant normally you shut the helicopter down. Well, they decided to fly anyway. Portland cleared the airspace, and they brought her in, and she died en route. She stopped breathing. Her heart rate stopped, and she had bled to death into her fracture sites along her back and in her pelvis. And my partner is a cardiac surgeon like I am, and he revived her, and he operated her for the rest of that day and that night. And I came on the next day, and I picked her up, and I took care of her for the next 3 months. And she made an extraordinary recovery. The orthopedic surgeon wanted to take her leg off. We avoided that. She graduated from college, went back to skiing, paradoxically enough, holds down two jobs, and she's very much alive.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Just amazing. In the Oregonian's piece, your analysis of accident victims was interesting. It appears from what you said, you can actually see the results of the states becoming more strict with younger drivers.
Yes. When I came to Oregon in 1983, Manuel had a 14-bed intensive care unit, and about 11 of the 14 beds were filled with kids under the age of 25 from automobile accidents. Usually the usual story was high school, party, you know, speeding, out of control, drunk, or whatever, and then you'd have these big pileups. And we went to the legislature. We got a group of nurses. We started taking pictures of these horrible damage done to these bodies and formed an organization called Trauma Nurses Talk Tough. And there's nothing more stimulating to a kid than have a nurse about their mother's age haranguing them about what could happen to them if they drank and drive. And we got a law passed, zero tolerance for alcohol for young drivers. And it just – we were lucky to have one out of 12 now in the bed, in an ICU bed from drinking and driving among the teenagers.
This is After Deadline. We've been talking with Dr. Bill Long, trauma surgeon. And when we come back from our break, we'll have a little dialogue between him and Dr. Bob Wayne. We're back with Dr. Bob Wayne and Dr. Bill Long, both occasionally work together at Columbia Memorial Hospital. One is a layperson. You see a lot written and a lot spoken about the difference between the physician coming out of medical school today and what he or she is looking for in the way of a life and the physician that came out of medical school 20, 30 years ago. What do you see? What's your observation on that?
The younger physicians today expect a better quality of life. That's what it's really about. Money isn't anywhere as important, I think, to them as the quality of life, the ability to go running when they want to spend time with their family. It's really palpable in every young physician, young surgeon that I meet. And that's the biggest change that I see. Their expectation of their work hours has changed dramatically. Bill and I were trained in an era where the doctor just worked. It wasn't a matter of how many hours. You just worked endlessly as long as you could stay awake sometimes. And you took almost feeling guilty your vacations. That's changed. These doctors fully expect much better hours, limitations on them, and a good reason for a good share of vacation time.
How do you see that, Bill?
Yeah, I think it's a different era, and I'm worried because I might be a consumer of the new doctors coming along. But I don't think they know as much. I don't think they have as much experience. A number of them who have finished their residency programs at both at University of Washington and Oregon Health Sciences University have asked me for additional training after they get through. And I don't know how we're going to make up for this issue. I admit that like Bob says, some of the hours we worked were perhaps inhumane. But medicine's a 24-hour business. It's not something you can shut it off, you know, and go home and then turn it back on again the following morning. It's a 24-hour business, and somebody has to know all the issues that are going on with the patient and provide the continuity. And I worry about, you know, the systems. Even with all the computers, I just don't see the continuity like we have. Maybe it's bound to change, but I don't like what's happening.
You mentioned to me on another occasion, I think it was the median age of the trauma physicians out in this part of the world.
Yes, the medical students who are graduating and the residents who are finishing up want to stay in the suburban urban areas. There are the school issues, there are the cultural issues, there are the family and social issues, and a lot of them are come from urban environments. I grew up in a rural community, a farming community. A lot of Dr. Trunke grew up in a rural farming community. A lot of the surgeons had that background, sort of were drawn to trauma because they saw the fatalities that occurred with farming accidents and as well as automobile accidents. It's hard to get youngsters that want to move to a community and make a lasting commitment to a rural community. And this is not just restricted to the West Coast. It's all over the country. And the only way I know around that is build, you know, these hospitals like Columbia Memorial Hospital into a vibrant medical community that does more sophisticated things. That might turn the difference.
Dr. Wayne, what has the nature of trauma emergencies that come into Columbia Hospital changed over the last 10, 20 years?
No, the nature hasn't changed, but what we're willing to keep at the hospital has. We transfer out, I think, much more quickly now seriously injured patients that we might have kept. The reason for that is that there's a lot more expertise at these big centers from multiple specialists that we just don't have. And sometimes patients don't understand that. It may look like a straightforward ruptured spleen or something that we can take care of here, but there are complicated issues, and that has changed so that we keep a lot less. For a number, we probably only see about 60 patients, I think, in a year that we transfer out for trauma. That's the ballpark number. We see a lot more than that for trauma activation, but I would say in that range, last time I looked, it was a few years ago.
And sitting in Portland, Dr. Long, what's been the biggest – you've mentioned one already, fewer younger drivers in beds.
That's been offset by the increase in the elderly. And it's the growing fastest growing portion of our population. But ground level falls. You know, people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and they get thrown by the throw rug or they trip on the going across sometimes with walkers. And they break their neck. They have a head injury. Many of them are on anticoagulation for heart problems and neurological problems. They get bleeds on the surface of their head. And the trauma service is the only place for them to be entered into where they can get a rapid response and get all the resources they need to try to save their life. So we are shifting into geriatric trauma as a major force because that's what's happening.
Well, thank you, Dr. Robert Wayne. And Dr. Bill Long, thanks for being on After Deadline today.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Yeah.